Hey, Penknife listeners. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and, of course, tell your friends about it. Thank you. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Santi.
Hello.
You guys remember how in season one, after everyone's favorite toxic white male writer, Norman Mailer, stabbed his wife in the chest, he was taken to the Bellevue psych ward in New York?
Yeah.
Well, it's a shithole, right?
It is indeed. I've had the misfortune of visiting a friend there.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But the one who I really feel sorry for, and who really got a bum rap, is Mailer. I mean, all he did was stab his wife in the chest. Granted, he only missed her heart by a matter of millimeters, but he didn't kill her. She made a full recovery. On the flip side, we got this guy, Hans Falada, who did not miss his friend's heart. He hit it spot on with a bullet and killed the guy, and Falada ends up in a sanatorium that was a former palace.
It's true. Of all the great injustices we've chronicled on this podcast, there was probably no worse than that done to Norman Mailer.
I know, it's so unfair.
Well, not everyone could have Hans Falada's luck. After a failed suicide pact duel in 1911 in which Falada survives but his friend is killed, he's taken to the Tannefield Sanatorium for the mentally ill. The estate, which was once a duchess's summer palace, contains a castle and carriage houses nestled on an idyllic hillside with meticulously manicured French gardens. Basically, it's a place for the rich to go for a respite and to nurse themselves back to health on a diet of caviar and foie gras.
But it's not all a walk in the literal park. It's still a psych hospital. And though there's not yet electroshock therapy or the kind of overprescribed sedatives that will later become commonplace in mental health facilities, there are plenty of disturbing rehabilitation methods, such as stretcher beds and isolation cells, which are favourites of the period.
Falada spends his time in Tannefield reading and translating. He starts with the work of the French writer Romain Rolland, and particularly Rolland's biography on Michelangelo. The translation will never be published, but this is the first time he really commits himself to a literary project, spending 6 to 8 hours a day on it.
It's worth noting that he also translated the work of two other writers who might someday justify the penknife treatment themselves. Painter and poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti and writer Gabriele D'Annunzio. In 1862, Rossetti's wife killed herself after their child was stillborn. Though he was cheating on her at the time, he was apparently so overwrought by her death that he buried all the poems he'd been working on alongside her. But then, a few years later, presumably lacking inspiration, he said, fuck it, and dug up the poems. As for D'Annunzio, he was a decadent proto-fascist aristocrat who, along with writing great books, is rumored to have worn shoes made of human skin and drunk wine from the skull of a virgin.
On that note, I'm Ramona Stout, I'm still living in Hanya, and I prefer to drink my wine from the skulls of Greek proto-fascists. It really accentuates the tannins.
And I'm Santiago Lemoine, a writer and bookseller from Buenos Aires. And I used to drink my wine from the skull of a dear friend whom I killed during a duel. But recently my doctor told me to cut down on my alcohol consumption, so now I limit myself to a single cup a day from the skull of a stillborn baby.
And I'm Corey Eastwood, a writer and bookseller from New York. And I don't drink wine, but you're listening to Penknife, a podcast about writers who may or may not have written about crime, but who definitely committed it.
In the summer of 1913, Falada is released from the sanatorium, having served less than 2 years for the death of his friend. Without a high school diploma and with a murder charge excused by insanity on his record, job prospects are, as you can imagine, bleak. Eventually, though, thanks to Dad's influence, he lands a job as a manager on an agricultural estate where he oversees maids, farmhands, and lumberjacks. The young poet, who was horrible at maths at school, actually proves adept at managing the books.
So as we know, this poor bastard Hans Falada had the great misfortune of living through World War II. But that wasn't the only war he endured. Some years earlier in 1914, when he's only had a year to try to get back on his feet after his release from the sanatorium, war breaks out in Europe, and soon Germany is fighting on both its eastern and western borders.
These days, most writers and intellectuals tend, in great majority, to be anti-war. But World War I is often considered the first modern war, the OG war, the war to end all wars, that kicked off the 20th century's epic bloodshed. It's not nicknamed the Great War for no reason. And as it's the first with modern weaponry, people don't yet have all of the examples of war's senseless death and suffering to look back on.
Yeah, and even the modern nation-state is still relatively young. The unified German Empire didn't begin until 1871, and some smart people are still naive about the perils or evils of nationalism. And in Germany, support for the war is widespread, including amongst writers. Even our guy Thomas Mann, who would go on to say that Falada's books should be pulped because their authors stayed in the Third Reich during World War II, wrote about World War I saying, "War, it was purification, it was liberation that we felt, an enormous hope."
Falada at this point is mostly interested in poetry and girls, but to the extent that he thinks about the war, he, like everyone else his age, wants to join, or at least agrees to join to appease his dad. The two of them go around to various recruitment centres, but none will take Hans given his history and medical report, which includes a declaration that he's permanently unfit for service. Finally, though, some desperate recruiter bites, and Hans joins the German army, ensuring victory for the Fatherland.
Ah, with poets that brave and fierce in their ranks, the Fatherland is sure to triumph.
After a torturous 11 days where he's constantly chastised and bullied, he's again declared unfit and sent home.
The good news is that with so many men fighting on the front, there are plenty of jobs available away from it, and Falada scores some good ones on big agricultural estates and eventually becomes an expert in potato cultivation.
Which is very important during the war years, because by 1915, with the blockades on imports, there's food shortages and rationing throughout Germany. Here Falada gets his first, though definitely not last, taste of real hunger. To keep potato prices affordable, the government fixes them, which in turn causes farmers to feed their potatoes to their pigs and sell the in-demand pigs off at highly inflated prices. This leads to a potato shortage and even more rationing of food staples. The winter of 1916 is called the Kohlruben winter, or turnip winter, because everyone is forced to eat turnips in place of potatoes.
Nothing wrong with a good turnip. I prefer them over potatoes, actually.
To each their own. But the interesting thing here is that while this is going on, Falada becomes a master potato man, who is, in his own words, able to distinguish 1,200 varieties of potato, and not only by name, but also by their appearance, eyes, the shape and color of the tuber.
Whoa, he's like totally tuberler.
Okay, I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that. So what happens next? He goes on to become the great German potato mogul?
No, in 1916, at the age of 23, he finally graduates out of Inseldom, and from there he's off to the races.
Hans, my boy, he finally, as we say in Spanish, wets his churro, or if you will, wets his German churro. Or what would they say? Dips his bratwurst in mustard?
Okay, now it's my turn to pretend I didn't hear that. So, instead of advancing his potato career or finishing his novel, Falada spends his time in cafes and his money on prostitutes.
And don't forget cigarettes. There might not be enough food to eat in Germany, but there are still plenty of cigarettes to smoke. And Falada is truly a legendary chain smoker. Think of a number of how many an epic chain smoker might consume in a day. Write that number down, and we'll tell you the answer in a later episode. Person to guess the number right gets a gift basket of assorted tubers.
Enticing. By 1918, all of his dicking around is taking its toll on him, and his parents are worried. So worried that they agree to his plea to fund a literary year for their son. The agreement is that he'll take a year-long sabbatical from the potato gig, and his dad will give him an allowance to write and finish his novel in progress, tentatively titled Sufferings of a Young Man in Puberty.
Best to just let that sit there. No comment necessary.
A month into his literary year, the family receives news from the front. Uli Ditzen, Hans's younger brother, has been killed during a disastrous counteroffensive in France.
Apart from writing as a form of therapy, Hans has never been very good at dealing with difficult emotions. Grief over his brother's death and the accompanying chain smoking eventually manifests itself in stomach ulcers. And while in the hospital to treat the ulcers, he tries a drug called morphine.
Like many writers, Falada is also a bibliophile and book collector. Later, in 1932, when he first makes some money from his writing, his first luxury purchase is a 65-volume set of Karl May novels.
Well, because he's largely forgotten today, I think we need to explain that Karl May was a massively popular 19th-century German adventure writer of both children and adult novels. And, along with Falada, another great admirer of his was the big Adolf H. He considered Karl May not just a great writer, but almost a mentor, and made sure his books were distributed to Nazi soldiers at the front.
Ouch. I didn't know that, but I referenced Falada's Karl May purchase to show A, what a dork Falada is, and B, how much books mean to him. But as soon as he gets that first sweet taste of morphine, he sells his entire 3,000-volume library to fund his habit.
I feel a bit bad saying this, but bibliophiles with drug problems are hands down a bookseller's best customers. Because not only are they constantly buying your books, they also then sell them back to you at a significantly reduced price, particularly opioid users. Nobody reads as much as them.
It's true. They're the best until they're really hard up, and then they just rob you like my boy Diablo in Brooklyn, or con you by borrowing money and never returning it like our friends CJ and Luisito here in Valencia.
Back to Falada. At the same time that he's mourning the death of his brother, getting hooked on morphine and trying to finish his novel, the German Empire is collapsing. Demonstrations, strikes, and street battles are commonplace throughout the country, and while Falada is vaguely in support of the revolution, his days are spent fixated on his puberty novel and his nights on prostitutes and his new love, morphine.
In January of 1919, he tries to kill himself again, this time by injecting oxygen into his veins. Of the attempt, he writes,
"And then a terrible thing happened. It didn't work. No matter where I injected, thick black blood came out, but no air would go into my veins. They were all rusted up. And that was fate again, for it was clear that I wasn't allowed to die, but had to live, to keep on living, on and on, to start all over again. So I put down the needle and embraced life once again. Dear life."
The war ends, the government topples, and the puberty novel, Young Goethestall, is published to mixed reviews and poor sales.
Well, given that the world had just been through a war, it's hardly surprising that the reading public isn't too interested in a story about peacetime adolescent angst.
No, it isn't. In any case, a new decade begins and sees Falada part writer, part farm administrator, and now full-blown junkie.
The 1920s in Germany are sometimes called the Golden Twenties, referring to the post-war years of economic stability and the new social liberalism that flourishes in the Weimar Republic. We think of it as an artistic renaissance where German cinema explodes with such classics as the expressionist masterpiece, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and Fritz Lang's legendary Metropolis. Design is forever changed for the cooler with the emergence of the Bauhaus school and artists such as Paul Klee and Wassily Kandinsky. And at the same time, Brecht is revolutionizing theater with his Threepenny Opera. And Christopher Isherwood's there gaining inspiration for what will become perhaps the most defining depiction of the era, his novel Goodbye to Berlin, and its musical adaptation, Cabaret. The decadence, the carnivalesque hedonism, the Art Deco style and flapper fashion of the time is pretty much as sexy as it gets. Couple that with what we now know happens next, and Berlin in the 1920s has to be one of the coolest, most romantic periods in human history.
Except that's only an image that's been filtered down to us by books, film, and television. The so-called Golden Twenties begin with Germany staggering under the weight of reparations it owes as a result of the Versailles Treaty. Inflation is at an all-time high, to such an extent that in 1923, 300 paper mills are working non-stop to churn out paper for new banknotes that are literally being printed 24 hours a day. Sure, there's glamour, but only a small subset of bohemian and bourgeois society gets to experience it. Falada isn't part of that world, and for him, the 20s just mean poverty, addiction, imprisonment, and more failure than success as a writer.
After getting out of another sanatorium where he's been, this time to cure his morphine addiction, he gets another job working in the administration of a big farm estate and gets back to writing. In an effort to stay away from morphine, he finds himself a new love, booze, and in particular, cognac.
As completely ridiculous as this sounds, it's still very common today. I've known several people that have called alcohol their methadone. They told themselves they could drink as much as they wanted as long as they didn't pick up the hard stuff, i.e. heroin or prescription opiates, which are the modern-day versions of morphine. The addict brain will perform all kinds of mental gymnastics to convince itself of its right to obliterate itself.
It doesn't take long for Falada to go from junkie to full-blown alcoholic, to then both junkie and full-blown alcoholic. The years 20 to 23 are spent in and out of sanatoriums trying and failing to get sober. He manages to maintain jobs at farms, but blows all the money on drugs, booze, and prostitutes.
Money, or the sufficient amount of money to maintain his various addictions, isn't easy to come by. Again, save a few years in the middle of the decade when things start to look up, Germany spends much of the 1920s in a severe economic crisis. There's mass unemployment and lots of people don't have enough food to eat. This is the atmosphere that dooms the Weimar democracy and leads to the growth of a number of radical political parties, including the communists and a group known as the National Socialists.
So, what do you do when you're broke and you need to feed a drug habit?
Lie, cheat, and steal?
Bingo. In October of 22, Fallert is arrested for trading large amounts of his employer's grain on the black market. He's eventually given a six-month sentence that begins in June of 1924. Now, he's already spent plenty of time in institutions, but it doesn't take long for prison, or at least this one in Greifswald, to become his favorite place to stay by court mandate. On his fourth day, he writes in his journal,
I've never been treated so decently in any sanatorium or mental hospital as I am here. As long as I do my work, no one bothers me. I can read, sleep, write, sing, walk up and down. No one interferes.
Falada's fellow inmates don't have that luxury. While Hans might not be bothering them to their faces, he is, in exchange for tobacco and other favors, squealing on them. He's ashamed of being a snitch, but justifies himself with,
But that's life. I have to survive. Let the stronger men be heroes and martyrs. I have only enough talent to be a small-scale coward.
He then continues,
Despite all my books, despite all my opinions, I am a born bourgeois. I always side with authority. But that isn't the whole truth either. I think I do it because I enjoy doing it, and because it makes me feel important. I'm a born spy, who acts in a mean way, not for the sake of my own advantage, but for the sake of meanness itself.
And with that brutally honest journal entry, Hans Fallada articulates the cowardice that was responsible for the Holocaust.
And that still thrives today in the form of police, middle managers, and sycophants of all shapes and sizes.
After his release in November of 1924, Fallada gets right back to living the dream. Writing, 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 plus drinking, drugging, and whoring.
In his autobiographical story, 3 Years of Life, he writes, For 7 years now, I've been a slave to one substance or another. It's been morphine, cocaine, ether, or alcohol. Sanatoriums, insane asylums, and the eternal struggle to make money for the demon poison that eats me.
In September of 1925, he embezzles 14,000 marks from his boss and takes the money to Berlin to go on an epic 5-day bender.
Animal, 5-day bender.
There you go. Hans gets to enjoy some of the Weimar decadence after all.
Well, sort of. But he doesn't really remember any of it when he wakes up hungover, penniless, and a lot worse for the wear. This isn't the type of crime where he was hoping he'd get away with it. Eventual apprehension was a certainty from the moment he took the money. But now that the time has come to face the music, he's worried that given his medical history and criminal record, there's a good possibility he'll receive a very long, perhaps lifelong, sentence to a mental hospital. Prison is in every way preferable to a life in the loony bin, so when he walks into the police station to turn himself in, he confesses not only to the crime of forging a check for 14,000 marks, but to 7 other crimes of theft and embezzlement, some of which he hasn't actually committed. It's such a preposterous, over-the-top confession that the cops think he's just a drunk nutter and send him away.
So there he is on the street, a free man without any money or prospects and desperately in need of a drink or a fix. Only there's nothing free about that feeling, and he decides that because prison has been the only place he's been able to stay clean and sober, that he has to do whatever it takes to get back there. So he goes straight back to the police station. This time, along with reinforcing their belief in his lunacy, he also convinces them that he's a criminal, and they arrest him.
It's a bona fide lucky streak for Hans, because not only does he get arrested, but he eventually convinces a court of his sanity. They rule him to be of sound body and mind, though, quote, a thoroughly degenerate psychopath, who can stand trial in criminal court. He pleads guilty to everything and is taken to Neumünster Prison, where he'll spend the next 2.5 years.
Once again, prison is good to Hans, as the order, routine, and lack of temptation allow him some peace. The darkness inside of him is still very much there, though, and without the quick fixes of drugs, booze, or sex, he turns to his favorite coping mechanism of all, writing.
Nothing of what he writes in prison will be published until 2021, after a bunch of stories were unearthed along with court documents. The press Scribe published a translation in 2022 titled Lily and Her Slave, and it's a great collection that shows Fallada honing his chops. But when he gets out of prison 2.5 years later, his preparation is over, and he's ready to make it big as a writer.
Unfortunately for Hans, he also has to eat, and he's just emerged from prison 33 years old with no money, no references, and an impressive criminal record.
And though the Weimar government has managed to pull things together a bit, and as a result, support for the National Socialist has waned, the next 5 years will see the unemployment rate quadruple.
Hans moves to Hamburg, where his parents help him out yet again, and he gets a job addressing envelopes for an advertising agency. During this period, he enjoys a warm meal exactly once a week. Otherwise, it's half a liter of milk a day and 2 kippers for lunch.
I absolutely hate milk, but I could probably live on kippers or herring for the rest of my life.
Anyway, the important thing in his life is not his new job, but his sobriety. For the first time in 15 years, Hans is clean and sober. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't exist yet, so Falada joins an abstinence organization called the Order of the Good Templar. It's a Freemason-inspired group that began in the US in the 19th century, and in the 20s, it's a pillar of the German temperance movement.
It's at the Templar Lodge that he meets a woman named Anna Issel, who's not a drunk herself, but someone who likes hanging around drunks. Well, sober drunks. Anna goes, for some reason, by the name Suze. She's a big bone, salt of the earth, working class woman, and for Hans, it's love at first sight.
Come on. Is no one else going to make a Big Suze reference here? Big Suze, Super Hans? Nobody? Okay, let it go.
Super Hans, Lucky Hans, what have you. In this period, our guy Hans is first and foremost sober Hans, determined to walk the straight and narrow. In 1930, when he marries Suze, he's got himself a job reporting for the newspaper in Neumünster, a small city in rural northern Germany. And he hasn't touched drugs or alcohol in over 4 years.
In many ways, Neumünster couldn't have been further from the temptation and fun of big city Berlin. The early years of the Fahleders' marriage are good ones. Hans works long hours as a journalist, and when he comes home, Suze has dinner on the table. Then they sit in the living room, Suze sewing and darning, while Hans reads aloud to her.
Darning, huh?
In everything I read about that wholesome time, the word darn was everywhere. It doesn't get any more wholesome than darning. And speaking of wholesomeness, Suze is soon pregnant.
So with a little German bun in the oven, our one-time thoroughly degenerate psychopath is now a good, upstanding citizen.
Why does it always have to be a German bun or a German churro? You got something against Germans?
No, nothing at all. I love Germans, particularly because they're one of the only nationalities you can make fun of with impunity. Plus, I'm just pointing out that in those days, the Germanness and Aryanness of the churros and buns was important, okay?
Okay.
Anyhow, outside the doors of the Falada scene of German domestic bliss, shit is getting real. The small farmers in the region are suffering economically, unable to pay their debt and taxes, and the government is responding by impounding their cattle. To protest these conditions, they informally get together into what's called the Landvolk Association, or the Rural People's Movement. They mostly engage in nonviolent protest and boycott, but also get down with some bombing of government buildings, including one that's placed inside the Reichstag.
Falada delights in covering all this for the local newspaper, not because he cares about the politics of it all, but because he instinctively sympathizes with the little man and enjoys seeing them fight back. In the end, and like usual, the little man pretty much loses, but Falada emerges with a novel called A Small Circus. It's a fictionalized account of the movement and the tense atmosphere in Neumünster between 1928 and 1930. His publisher decides that the name isn't sensational enough, so they change it to Farmers, Functionaries and Fireworks, or if you prefer the translation, Peasants, Bosses and Bombs. Anyhow, in English, it's now been restored in a current Penguin edition as A Small Circus.
It's Falada's first major work, and while it might not be his best, and it isn't, it, like pretty much all of his work I've read, is an absolute delight. But it's more than a good read. It's actually an important historical document.
Yeah, I hate when people throw around the word important. Oh, you have to read this novel. It's so important. Important to whom?
Fair enough. But I think you'll agree that the part of history that the Landvolk movement impacts is widely considered to be a pretty important part of the 20th century. And that's because while it starts out as a bunch of apolitical farmers who haven't read Marx or spent much time studying Berlin politics, the publicity it receives means that soon all the parties want a piece of it. From the Social Democrats, the party in power, to the Communists, to the various smaller parties on the right and left, and a faltering little political party that in 1928 is hemorrhaging votes and Reichstag seats and looks set to fade away, the National Socialists.
Okay, I see where you're going with this. Fine, I guess important it is.
After reading about it in newspapers like the one Falada wrote for, Nazi organizers and agitators are there on the front lines handing out their propaganda and adapting it to fit the movement's goals. It's no coincidence that the blood and soil slogan, an aspect of Nazi ideology, really begins to take shape around this time. The Nazis are all of a sudden the farmer's best friend, and the art they start to celebrate and produce idealizes rural life, linking the farmer's white race and blonde hair to the land, fertility, and all things good.
German churros, German buns, and German tubas.
Exactly. And it works. In that region, the National Socialists held 4% of the vote in 1928, compared to 27% in 1930.
It also means that when Falada's novel comes out, and it's clearly with the farmers and against the Social Democrats and crumbling Weimar government, the Nazis love it.
My enemy's enemy is my friend.
Right. Goebbels calls it masterly. But the funny thing is that some communists, who also hate the Social Democrats, praise it for the same reason. The majority of the left, though, dislikes it for its political implications, and some even label it fascist.
The truth is that it's a clear, often hilarious account of all the various players involved in the conflict. A reviewer calls it a political textbook of the fauna germanica that could not be bettered. Günter Kasper writes, quote, "No one was a clean slate. Everyone has dirt on everyone else. There is so much must and stench, greed and false ambition, envy and hatred. So much dirty laundry is aired, so many drunks, whores, fools, cowards, swindlers, hypocrites, and liars. There are so many bad qualities on display here that it's hard to believe they can all fit into one novel."
But they do. By looking at society on different levels, from the journalists to the police to the farmers, politicians, and business interests, it's kind of like a 1920s Northern German version of The Wire. Everyone's a victim, and everyone's guilty.
Falada's crime is not anticipating the consequences of writing a novel that so thoroughly dismantles the system at a time when the system's most powerful enemies were Nazis. Literal Nazis.
Anyway, while it isn't a huge hit, the book does well enough to change Falada's identity from that of a thoroughly degenerate psychopath to an author of note.
With the publication of A Small Circus in 1931, it looks like Hans has finally made it. He and Suze are now living in Berlin, and she's just given birth to their first child, Uli. Hans says fatherhood makes him feel like a millionaire. And though he's definitely not one, and money's still tight, he's taken a job working in his publisher's review department that allows him plenty of spare time to write novels. The 30s are poised to be Hans's decade.
The German 1930s?
Yeah, the German 1930s.
Good luck, Hans.
We'll see how he fares next week on Penknife.
Penknife is created, written, and produced by Corey Eastwood, Ramona Stout, and me, Santiago Lemoine. Hans Falada is voiced by Finn Lopsin. The sound design, music, and all things audio are the work of Diego Sanchez of La Pianola Studio in Buenos Aires. The logo and all things visual have been made by Nelly Cuellar Torres. Flor Lopez built our website, penknifepodcast.com, where you can find a full bibliography of the works we used in researching this episode. And again, thanks to El Herbster for letting us turn his spare bedroom into a recording studio. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and tell your friends about the show. We're not going to lie to you. We've made these 3 seasons ourselves with very little financial support, and it's been a struggle. We really want to continue to make Penknife, but in order to do so, we need your likes and reviews. Even if you think it's shit and you just want to chime in to tell us to stop wasting our time and money making this podcast, we'd love to hear it.